So, let's pass on to Jeff Tanzer, who is going to speak for a bit and then perhaps draw a bit on the board if we can find the pens.
Yes, I've got one here.
You got one there? Good. And Jeff is the trustee of the Food Ethics Council, is the author of this wonderful book, Future Control of Food. If you've not seen and read it before, downloadable from the IDRC website. I'm sure you'll talk about that a bit. And is a very hopeful thinker on these issues. Jeff, over to you.
Thanks. Three basic things. To talk first about how we've seen a whole set of new enclosures in the last 20 years as the rules of the world have been written. It's not enclosing land. This time it's enclosing knowledge, it's enclosing seeds, it's enclosing innovation and channeling it into particular firms and particular ways of doing it. And that's happened through the extension of these snappily titled things called intellectual property rights, patents, plant variety protection, copyright and so on. And these are really going in the very opposite way to we've all been talking about before. Because farming and agriculture and human societies have thrived best when people share knowledge. Science has worked best when it's been a sharing of knowledge, when we've recognised things are a common heritage of humankind and the serendipity that comes from sharing works. But this is about creating scarcity where there is not, by a legal means. And what we've actually done are created things that are in reality monopoly or exclusionary privileges, but they've all been designed because society wants certain things. They're social things that we make up. Coming in this environment, I'm thinking, did they film Harry Potter here? You know, I mean, Harry Potter's a work of fiction, and it's great for amusement and entertainment. The law is a work of fiction, but it constrains what we do and it shapes what we do. But remember, all laws are fictions, and then we make them up. And these are a set of rules and laws that have been made up and actually introduced by a small number of corporations very successfully over a period. Starting in the United States, they underpin the entire genetic engineering revolution and the move of chemical companies into seeds. And they've been embedded into global rules through their extension into the World Trade Organization. And all this has gone into an enormous and long detail in here, and you can read about it. But that, in a nutshell, is one of the key things that's gone. And it's affecting how we think about biodiversity, about plant genetic resources, and negotiations that happen in Rio and everywhere else. The other thing that the patent system is now doing is facilitating a form of private taxation. Large states need to finance themselves by exercising taxes on us. Corporations need to finance themselves by getting profits. And what the patent system is increasingly allowing them to do is to charge what they want in different markets. So if you're rich, we'll charge a lot for this product. If you're poor, we'll charge a little, and we'll stop the products moving between places. And Peter Drahos has written very well about this. So what does this stuff do? It really has changed the way research is happening. I mean, Michelle and lots of people have talked about research. But it's been based upon a sharing of knowledge historically, and public research for farming has gone on because farmers are little players who don't have the resources. And a healthy food system and a farming system is in all our interests. So in a modern state, and in modern states, we've actually funded public good research to be a benefit. But all of that has disappeared very much, particularly in Britain, and led by Mrs. Thatcher and her gang from the 70s in the closure of a lot of the public research institutes and so on. But what's happening now with people wanting to somehow make money out of it and turn universities into businesses, basically, is they want to have patents taken out. So they don't want you going sharing the knowledge until you've actually had lawyers deal with it. But more subtly, what this does is skews the questions we ask. So if there's looking for a solution to the problems that we face, the challenges, and we're not going to though, we know those climate change and competition over resources, then the questions that will be asked is how can we, and it was well illustrated in the soils session this morning, where one of the guys was talking about biofortification. What he meant was actually making the soil healthier, having sufficient range of minerals in it, so what grew out of it was good, from what you ate off it gave you a healthy nutrition. Now, what biofortification means in this framework is, can we re-engineer the plant or the animal in a way that we can patent it and control it to have an extra nutrient? As was said by Julie, it's a very narrow way of thinking. and it's really changing the way science is being done. And it's really going in the wrong way. From what has historically been an open access distributed system of innovation. And who are our allies in this? People who want designer genes. People in the music business. Kids who are being criminalised because of the copyright system. People who are concerned about access to medicines. Because what's going on in seeds and intellectual property is fundamentally about what kind of future do we want and who's going to run it. What is the real effect it has? There's a fantastic graphic. This has been videoed. There's a video presentation. I haven't got locked up. But it shows you in the last 15 years how the big red chemical companies, and if you do this as a video, it kind of, you can't see these at the beginning over 15 years, but slowly they move around. They buy up the seed companies. And it creates a system where we have a very few large corporations who are now buying up lots of the seed companies. But this is not just in this field. This has had a real impact in us. So this stuff called intellectual property and patents really matters. And it's where law is another issue that we have to engage with. Who are our allies in law? Company law has to be thought about. All kinds of areas that we've not dealt with. Now, the intellectual... I would argue that we've got very different futures. Patrick talked about it at the beginning. I use more crude language than this, but the Standing Committee on Agricultural Research's third foresight report from the European Commission, believe it or not, is a really good document. And they say, really, we've got two narratives for the future. A productivity one, which is really the techno-fix. And it underlies most of the science and technology here, a lot of what you hear at the other conference from scientists, and the mindset that Julia's referring to. And fundamentally, it says, we humans are clever enough to get our way out of any problem, and frankly, nothing else on the planet matters. Push it far enough and that's what is there at the heart. It assumes economic growth in a kind of unquestioning manner, and it assumes that demand somehow exists out there and is unaffected by anything we do, unaffected by advertising, unaffected by all kinds of marketing strategies and so on, and that diets are naturally going to become all like the United States, etc. That's the kind of productivity narrative, and it's what the dominant thinking and the way the kind of science we've heard fits into. It actually, I would call it, in reality, it's a kind of techno-fix with corporate feudalism. Because it's a world in which a few large corporations will own and run everything, and your relationship to them will be increasingly feudal. You'll have a license to use this software, to listen to the music, to plant the seed. And it's a very undemocratic kind of world. The other narrative that they talk about is the sufficiency one, which is what we're talking about. It's ecological balance. It's about diversity. It says equity matters. It does matter. I would argue one of the biggest indicators of de-development in the world is the increasing number of billionaires. They should be seen as an anti-development measure. We need new metrics to explain what's going on in the world. The reality of what's happening, and this is drawing on work from colleagues in the Department of Peace Studies, is that it's the productivity narrative that is on the rise and that is bought into by the elites globally, and it's the one that sees a world splitting, the bifurcation, where the richest 1.5 to 2 billion, whether they live in Bombay or Bradford or Boston or wherever, are going to live longer and better using every trick of the book, and the rest will carry the can, or will have technologies of control to keep them under control. It's an illusion, but it's an attractive illusion if you're in the top billion, which we all are, by the way. So there are really issues. Food is at the heart of what kind of future we're going to have. And what kind of world our children and our grandchildren are going to have. And you could argue the case for the first one if it was done with equity. It's not an argument I'd like to take, but it's an entirely anthropocentric one. Says all that matters is us, and if we did this with equity, it'd be fine. It's not the way we're going. I think what we're trying to say is, look, we know what human societies thrive on, what enjoyable lives are, and food is right at the heart of it. So the last bit I want to do is talk about and move us into that thinking about action. Who takes it? Where, when, how, in what direction? What are the opportunities? And by the way, this is it. For the most important picture in the history of the human, the first time we saw ourselves, because this is all we've got, not very hospitable for food and farming, or anywhere else that we know of. And so we have to think, local, regional, national, EU, international, it's all in here. And the things we have to do is start connecting them. So how do we start to connect it, and how do we figure out what our bit of the action is? Because we're looking at a lot of both ends. This is not an either-or business. So I thought, I did soil science in my first degree, and when I did a talk about this in the States, and I set up a workshop, and I had no idea how I was going to run. Actually, the answer does lie in the soil, and if you've been into the soils area. Because what we're trying to deal with is a complicated, multidimensional thing. Now, soils are a space-time continuum. What does that mean? If you walk across them, they change under your feet. And if you stand on them long enough, they change while you're standing there. And we're dealing with the problem of taking action at different levels. So you'll discover I can't draw in there. What is the question? One of the axes that we're thinking about is who takes what action. Well, we tend to take action as individuals, and as individuals in communities, and in through corporate bodies, the body politic or corporate actors. Then we have to ask, to what end is that action directed? And here I'll pick up Colin's work, but add an extra R. Colin talks about revolution, reform, and renaissance, and I'd add a further one, resistance. So we've got these different ends to which action might be directed. And then the next one, and here I'll draw on the work of Donella Meadows, Thinking in Systems. Strongly recommended, very clear way of helping thinking about systems. She was the lead author of The Mr. Growth, which, by the way, was thinking 40 years ahead, was when it was published in 1970. And she talks about the leverage points that we're trying to affect. And we've heard of them this morning. She lists about 14. From the least effective in bringing about system change, and as Julie has made very clear, what we're saying is, this is about how do we run the world, what's the mindset we run it from, the paradigm. So if you want to have big shift in a system, you change the mindset. The least effective thing of getting about change is fiddling with the numbers. The numbers who are hungry or flows, there's all kinds of 13. I'm just going to pick a few at the top. Another is maintaining the capacity for self-organisation. It's the Renaissance bit, people doing their own thing, having the capacity, the resilience to adapt and change. It's looking at the rules and the frameworks and so on. So, as an individual, I'm interested in revolution, and Julia is, in the mindset. I'm interested in reform, in the rules and incentives. The incentives to produce science that serves the interests that we want. That means what kind of peer system have we got? Peer-reviewed literature, the higher education framework for judging the quality of science is presents the wrong incentives. The incentives in the financial system give the wrong incentives to deliver what we want, so we have to think about those. I'm interested in maintaining and encouraging self-organisation, or what Colin calls resistance. And that is the point of the transition time movement, the food sovereignty movement coming up from the bottom, organising, being active, a renaissance from the bottom. But also, it's also about resistance, resisting to those things that are going in the wrong direction and actually making clear where that is. And then the four, now, can I do this? This is actually a four-dimensional thing. Right. Because the other element we have to think about, and this doesn't fit into a neat line, and it's the issue that actually, surprisingly, the Oxford Farming Conference was talking about this year, is power and control. Who has what power and control? Risks and benefits. This is dynamic, and it shifts. So when we're working and thinking about where we're operating, we have to also think about what gives groups power and control. The rules on patents, the rules on intellectual property provide the opportunity for the kind of a development you see commercially that leads to these structures. Having lots of money gives you a lot of influence. Having a political system that allows people who worked in the public sector to immediately go into the private sector and then sell all that they know on how to subvert the public sector, it gives you power. It gives you access to control. Who carries risks? Small farmers manage risk brilliantly. GM, if there are risks, the issue is we're not going to carry them. So the liability issue. So those are the things we have to look at. Then I think when we move on now to these boards and the discussion, and what I want is, we don't want discussion about whether something, it's not about the substance, the lots of ideas we need to bring out. So it's, if we think about this year, January to December, when and where are the things where we should be acting? Patrick's talked about Rio plus 20. What are the things that go on there? In terms of the transition town movement, are the key points this year? If we're talking about where, are we saying local councils? Someone said that there's a more opportunity often with local councils. National government, where are the levers? Where are the bits that we can move in? Internationally, the EU, the reform of CAP, a lot of stuff on the agenda. The new research programme for the EU. We're now an innovation union, by the way, that's the jargon. The knowledge-based bioeconomy is the other jargon. And let's not let them redefine our language. Let's also redefine their language. Of course we want a knowledge-based bioeconomy. It's an ecologically-based bioeconomy. It's got equity at its heart. And those are the kind of things we want to start playing around with and discussing with you. And I have now finished, and I had finished, so this is quite good. So over to you folks. That's it.
Thank you very much indeed, Jeff. And he set the scene for what we want to do now.